The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What does it mean to be educated? I would like to approach it from the perspective of just the Hebrew word itself. The Hebrew word for education is chinuch. And the way that's written is chet yud nun vav chaf. Chinuch. I'd like to explore the word in terms of its original context. And I'd like to begin by just sharing a little bit about my background or my struggles with education. When I was growing up in Toronto, I did Baruch Hashem, thank God, I did very well in school. And so I was always under the impression that I was educated, or that I was in the process of being educated. And the reason why I was under that impression is because I was getting very high marks. You know, that felt good, and everybody said, that's great. And I was told at a very young age that because I am such a success from an educational standpoint, I have a lot of options open to me, and as a Jew, I could become a doctor, or a lawyer, or an accountant, because that's basically what Jews are supposed to become. That's what I was told at a very young age. So at a very young age, although all my friends, when you'd ask them at 5 years old, what would you like to be? You know, at 5 years old, you want to be a fireman or a hockey player, something very exotic and interesting. So at 5 years old, I already wanted to be a doctor. So I don't know, in terms of education or indoctrination, but at a very young age, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. And when people ask me, well, which kind of doctor would you like to be? I had no idea there were different kinds of doctors. So I used to make a little joke and say, I want to be a witch doctor. Because people ask me, which doctor you want to be? So, it's funny for a five-year-old kid to say it. My age, that's so funny. But anyways, okay. So, I was doing very, very well. On the other hand, my parents decided to give me a Jewish education. Now, I didn't understand why I would need a Jewish education, because I was a big success in education already. I was getting high marks and getting all these nice compliments in school. But for some reason, my parents decided, no, no, it's not enough. And they sent me to Hebrew school, which was an added 2 hours to my public school secular education. Now, I found that hard to understand why I was going to be doing that. My parents explained that I was one of the chosen people. And as part of the chosen people, we have certain added things that we do, like more school. And I thought that was really kind of bizarre. So I was doing very, very well in my public school. But when I got to Hebrew school, there was another side that was evoked in me. Something very deep inside me. And I recall my father getting the report card from public school, which were, you know, great marks and nice comments. And then the report card from Hebrew school, which, in public school I was getting A's, A minus, and in Hebrew school I was getting gimels and dalids and A's, which is really quite poor. And then certain remarks like, David is a disgusting, good-for-nothing, rotten kid. Please take him out of our Hebrew school. And I know something about Hebrew school that just got the best of me and allowed me to really express myself. That was really kind of bizarre. What I felt in Hebrew school educationally is I was just basically bored. I was upset. I didn't want to be there. And I remember the Hebrew school teacher talking about Moses and how he split the Red Sea. And at that time, I don't know, at that age, when I was very young, it didn't impress me. You know, I don't know. I thought of, well, if Superman was in that position, then he would have picked the whole people up and fly them over. And I had all these. So I was kind of disappointed in the superheroes of my Jewish heritage, when really, in my secret life, superhero were Batman, Superman, and they're Jewish names, you know, Steinman, Jackman, you know, Batman, Superman, these are Jewish names too. And so in my life, I didn't see these as models. Moses and Aaron, you know, Batman and Robin were more really where I was at. And so Hebrew school really was, for me, very much a waste of time. Not a complete waste of time, but for me, it was somewhat of a negative experience. On the other hand, I learned something very valuable in Hebrew school. Because when I was in Hebrew school, and bored out of my mind, and very, very resentful of being there, and feeling very distressed that I had to stay there until I would be liberated at age 13, so I remember, without any other resort, I began to pray. And I would say that my first prayers really started in Hebrew school. And I prayed to God quite regularly in Hebrew school, and I would pray and I'd say, please God, you took the Jewish people out of Egypt. Can't you take me out of Hebrew school? And that prayer stuck with me for quite some time, and God took quite a long time to answer my prayer. But at age 13, I had my bar mitzvah, and I made a lot of money, and I was out. I was out of Hebrew school for quite some time. So this is give you a little educational background of myself, and I just want to look at all that in a moment. When I was high school, however, then I took education a little more serious. I was more aware of, yes, I'm being educated. And then I really had a dilemma about what's really going on. When I was a kid, I really didn't know. I mean, they tell you this is what you do. They say you're a success, and they say this is what you do, and you like it or you don't like it. But when I was in high school, I started to kind of introspect about what really is going on here, and what am I trying to accomplish here. And I recall very vividly evenings before exams or tests. You know, those are the most stressful times, where I'm really nervous about the marks, and I'm cramming away, and I'm the type of person, I have a very poor long-term memory. I remember experiences. I'm a very right-brain kind of person, as you'll probably learn to see in the next 3 weeks. But in terms of long-term memory facts, I don't remember facts very well. Short-term, gee, you know, I could certainly cram it in, and within the next 24 hours, I could hold on to it. And so I remember feeling very, very nervous before an exam, and I would very rarely prepare for a test more than the night before. And then I'd go meshuggah, like I'd go nuts. And I would just really, and I'd go to bed like 2 in the morning. And it was those nights that were the most disturbing, because just as I'm about to try and fall asleep, there would be this little voice inside that would say, what are you doing? Why are you so nervous? Why do you care? Blow it off! Don't show up. Rebel. And I would say, cut it out. Who are you anyways? And I would try but then as I'm just trying to fall asleep, I would hear this little voice inside say, what's it all about anyways, David? I mean, what are you really trying to accomplish? Where do you want to be? Who are you? Why are you? And these questions were the questions that really, really disturbed me. And I realized that none of these questions were being addressed in my school. I was never being tested on these questions. I knew that these were not going to be on the exam tomorrow. Not once did I enter into a test which said, first question, who are you? Second question, why are you? Third question, and what will you be? That was never on the exam. Never, never. But what was on the exam, what I was being tested on, was retention of information. Okay? Certain exams. And then there were other exams that were testing me in terms of my thinking skills, problem solving, and that really bothered me a lot. Why did it bother me? Because I did very well, okay? I did very well. After the exam, I walk out, I felt, you know, I did very well. But after the exam, just from the sheer relief of it being over, I know I forgot about 30% of the material. Just with that first, that was 30% of it out the window. Then we went out to, you know, Burger King, and then, while I'm munching away on a burger, I would say another 20% was gone. And quite frankly, you know, the joke of my family is, when I was in high school, I was taking French. You know, in Canada, if you're from Canada, you learn French at a very young age. You never really know why you're learning French. I mean, it comes in handy to read the box of Rice Krispies, Rice Krispies, you know. Yeah, now I know what it is. So, you know, it comes very handy to be able to read the back of cereal. But like in Canada, unless you're in Montreal and Quebec, why am I learning French? But okay, that's what you do, and that's what you're tested on, and you get a lot of ego strokes when you're able to, you know, to speak French. And then it came to, like, my later years in high school, and I had this big decision. Should I continue to take French? Am I going to continue to become perhaps the ambassador, you know, for France or something? I mean, you know, I don't know what you could be doing with this stuff. And it was a very difficult decision, but I decided to trash French. And the funny thing, I thought, when would French ever come in my life? And sure enough, I meet a French girl, whose parents meet French, and I can't understand a word they say behind my back. But so it would have come in handy. But, you know, that was really what I felt about a lot of the courses that I was taking, and I didn't feel comfortable to go into university because I felt that the questions that I really needed to have answered or resolved for me to go into the university and make those choices, those course decisions, those life decisions of who I am and what will my role be in society, I felt, and I'm not in any way implying that this is what you experienced in your school, but this is what I experienced in my education, although a lot of people in the room are going, right? That I felt I wasn't ready. I felt, after all my high marks, after being told that I could get into any university I want, I felt I wasn't educated, right? And that really threw me for a loop. because the kind of questions that I was really, really hoping to be resolved before I got to adulthood, so to speak, I felt were very rarely addressed, if at all, in my formal schooling. Whether it was Hebrew school, where I was memorizing the names and the dates and the events, or whether it was my public school, that was my experience. I'm not giving a critique on the educational system of America. That's not for me to do. I'm only critiquing my own personal experience. I must admit, though, that when I was in high school, there was one course that particularly interested me and I found very, very relevant, and that was sex education. Now, that was interesting, you know, and that everybody showed up to. People would show up to. But the interesting thing was that during the whole time that the course was being given, I had a friend next to me, a guy named Sheldon. And Sheldon the whole time is telling me, it's not that way. It's not true. It doesn't happen that way. And so I really had two notebooks. One that Sheldon told me. And the other one, and the truth is, Sheldon was right. But I memorized, I memorized the course material for the exam, but I never forgot what Sheldon said. Anyways, so much for my education. Now, I did have those questions, and how would I deal with those questions was a major issue for me in my later years in high school, and I basically dealt with those deep, ultimate questions of life in two ways. One was rock and roll, and two was comedy. And those were my solutions to the questions. I realized that I had no answers to these questions. I realized that the people around me were not in any way offering or in any way addressing these questions. So what I decided to do is to simply run away from these questions and deny them. So I really had this fantastic stereo system in my room with all the latest hits, which are probably today like ancient, but The Who and the Rolling Stones. And these were really the people that helped me soothe the pain of these irking questions within me. And then the other approach I had was I had a theory called the clown theory, which is whenever you get serious, right, that's the time to really start joking, okay? And that's the time to make, you know, fun out of everything, because don't take it too serious, have a good time, and eat, drink, and be merry. That was really very much a philosophy I adhered to, because that was what I felt was available. So in essence, my experience or my disappointment in what I was being presented, for me anyways, about education, was education means retaining information, okay? And education means developing certain skills of thoughts and problem solving. And I could solve various mathematical problems, I could solve various physics problems, various chemistry problems, but I felt I wasn't able to solve my personal problems, okay? And I didn't really feel I had too many more than anybody else in this world. So then, my question to myself was, so am I educated? Am I educated? If I got into the top university for medicine, will they ask me on the exam, are you a good person? Or is that at all part of being accepted into medical school? I'm not saying yes or no, but these were questions that I had, and these are questions that bothered me. What is the essence of education from a Jewish point of view? Right? What are we trying to accomplish from a Jewish point of view? Well, the word for education is chinuch. Okay? Chinuch, as I pointed out before. You know, according to Jewish tradition, words have meaning. In other words, if you could take a word and it correlates to another word, so there's some kind of that parallelism, okay, gives indication to somewhat of the meaning of the word, because there's no such thing as education in Judaism. There's chinuch. And then we try to find some English word that are somehow, you know, replicate what we're trying to say in Hebrew. And that, by the way, is one of the greatest obstacles to really overcome to get a Jewish education, is to stop translating Hashem into God. There's such a word in Judaism as God, okay? But that's the English word, so that's what we use. And what does it mean for us? That's something we'll have to explore. Or things like love. We don't have a word like that in Judaism. We have something called ahava. But what's its original meaning within itself? And that's something that we really need to explore. So too over here, there's such a thing as education in Judaism. There's something called chinuch. And at best, if you open up a dictionary, you'll find next to it the word education. But I'd like to try and feel the word, you know, experience the word from within itself. So from just a technical, linguistic point of view, the word is connected to another word in Hebrew called chen. Okay? Chen. Chet nun. Okay? What does chen mean? Alright? What does the word chen mean? Anybody ever hear that word? Because it's a word that you use in Yiddish too. I mean, if you have Yiddish grandparents and parents, then you might hear the word chayn. You know, what is chayn? Not chrein, that's something we eat with our gefilte fish, which is probably some other mystical connection, but we'll save that for the advanced Israelite. Okay, have you ever heard the word chayn? you see a person who has chen. What is that? What is a person who has chen?
Virtue.
Oh, virtue, true. But that's virtue. That's not, I mean, that's part of the chen. Everyone know what chen is? Okay, that would be part of chen. If a person didn't have menschkeit, they certainly wouldn't have chen. Chen would be translated, I would say, in English, something to the extent of grace. There's something of grace to this person, but not grace in terms of, you know, ballet. But there's something about them, a certain special quality. Chen is a certain favorable, there's something attractive about him. You're right, it's hard to give a word to it. There's a certain spark, a certain magic to this person. Did you say match? Mensch. That would be part of the chen. But the chen itself is, there's something synergistic about this person. Isn't that an interesting word? Synergistic about that person that's very attractive. Alright? Now, to better appreciate this word, I'd like to contrast it to another word which could be misunderstood to be the same thing. And that's yafeh. You know what yafeh is, or yafa? Yafa? Hebrew? Anyone know? Pretty, beautiful. He yafa. She is pretty. Or hu yafeh. He is, why not, pretty, handsome. Okay, pretty boy. Alright? Yafeh. How does yafeh contrast to chen? Okay?
Inner versus outer.
Ah, very nice. Inner versus outer. Okay, let's give an example. Let's try and feel what chen would be in contrast to yafi. Yafi is pretty, you know, beautiful. Yafi is a woman I once met many years ago who was in a model, right? At the time I was teaching, and my wife and I invited this woman for Shabbat. She was yafeh. She was very yafah. You know, she's a model, successful model. You know, I invited her for Friday night at her home, which we tried to have people over as often as we could. And I had made a mistake. The mistake was I forgot that just that very Friday night I had also invited 5 yeshiva guys. Okay? There were no other women besides my wife. And I realized that maybe that was an inappropriate kind of guest list to have this model, you know, and these 5 yeshiva guys who've been hitting the books for the last, you know, while there in a very, you know, all-male environment. Realizing that these guys are, I'm sure, at a very high level, that this would not in any way disturb them, but nonetheless, it was too late to change the guest list, so I rationalized it. And what happened was the 5 guys were sitting there on the couch. It was Friday night. Well, I walk in with our other guest, Miss America, and in she walks, and these guys are just like, kind of like, you know, they were just really kind of taken by her beauty. And I realized that, I think I made a mistake. Well, we all sat around the table, and the energy was quite clear, and it was clear that the guys were going to try to really strike up a conversation and really get to know who this person is. One guy turned to her and asked her a very simple question about herself. And in the process of her answer, there was something going on in the room. And the guys kind of looked at each other. There was a lot of language in the eyes. And the evening was solved, and no one really seemed to be too much more interested in her. She had said something, and I don't even recall what it was. But whatever it was turned them off. She had her yuffie, but she did not have her chay. In other words, the people in the room immediately experienced that there was something inside that was somewhat not aesthetic, to be nice. Okay? Not aesthetic. Aesthetically, externally, very attractive. Scratch the surface, get to know her a little bit better, and there was really something inside that was not yafeh, and was not chen. Chen is an inner beauty. Chen is an experience that you feel when perhaps you date somebody or you meet somebody, someone's going to set you up on a blind date, and they tell you they're very attractive, you know, very attractive person, and you get to the door, and sure enough, you know, you meet wherever you meet, and you're just in a little bit shock because this person is not attractive, okay? And you're thinking to yourself, oh, gee, how could I speed up this evening? How am I going to spend a whole evening with this person? They just don't attract me, all right? And yet, have you ever had the experience where you met somebody and they didn't attract you, and you were going to be polite for 5-10 minutes, and then you would just excuse yourself with a stomach ache or something, and yet after 5 or 10 minutes of conversation, something changes, and now they're kind of interesting, right? And then about another half an hour, and you get to talk to them a little more, and all of a sudden, they're even kind of cute, grows on you, right? But then as time goes on, and it's really moving, you know, all of a sudden, there's something very, very attractive about them, all right? That's really a bizarre experience that a lot of people have had. Where all of a sudden, their face actually changes. Have you seen that? Have you seen a picture of a friend whereby that picture just doesn't look like them? In other words, you have pictures that captured the person, pictures that didn't get that out. Isn't a camera the most objective of vehicles? No, that's the important point here. What I perceive is not completely objective, but rather there's something within me and there's something within you that participates in defining the reality as I see with my very eyes. With my very eyes. And that's what's going to happen. You know, I mean, everybody kind of walked in, kind of looked around. Some people say, gee, I'm going to spend the next 3 weeks with these people. But as we kind of open up and we share, all of a sudden, just, we'll end up, and it was a total different people. And yet, really, that was the person. I just didn't have that deeper encounter. Chayin is an inner beauty. An inner attraction. Okay? Chayin is an inner attraction. That really becomes manifest externally. All right? Chayin is very much connected in the Bible, in the Torah, to a personality by the name of Yosef. Yosef had a lot of chayin. Okay? And the interesting thing about him is, although this didn't happen for his brothers, but the story goes, very often strangers appreciate you more than your own siblings. Well, that's unfortunately the fate of Yosef for quite some time. That strangers, I mean, his brothers were threatened by him. And yet strangers trusted him. Strangers entrusted him. And allowed him to represent them. Okay? And knew that he would represent their best interest. Why? Because there's something about this individual that's got an insight so put together. There's something about this individual that is so harmonious with the whole that you really feel, or you really see yourself in this person. You feel absolutely no conflict, but rather you feel that this person is so whole that whoever you are, they can incorporate within themselves, and therefore there's a natural attraction you feel for the person with chayin. Because the person with chayin, you feel, has a part of you in them too. Okay? Now, what does all this have to do with education? Education is really a journey of self-discovery. It really is. In the process of education, you should be succeeding in discovering your unique chayin. And what is your unique chayin, which chinuch, God willing, is bringing out in you, or uncovering, exposing within you? It is that harmony between yourself and all that which is beyond yourself. And that somehow all that is beyond yourself is reflected in a very unique way in you. And that's why people like you, right? People naturally like you. And that harmony, that beauty, that inner symmetry will in fact be manifest outside and you become as beautiful as you feel. Okay? But if you really feel that beauty inside yourself, that's really what education at its highest point would hopefully be aspiring to accomplish. That you discover, and you allow that discovery to become not a private thing, right? But it becomes so much on you. People are going to see that you're very connected. People are going to see that you're very much uniquely you, and that unique way that you interface, and the whole of the whole interfaces with you. It's not retaining information, although information might be fertilizer for that. Okay? It's not efficiency skills, although those skills would in fact hopefully help you really solve those problems, really deal with those dilemmas, which is all part of that discovery of my inner self. But the essence of the essence is a real self-affirming experience, whereby I begin to experience that harmony, that connectedness between myself and the all. The all and myself. And people are naturally going to gravitate to those kind of individuals. They're going to see your beauty, because they're going to see the beauty of everything reflected within you. That's a very high, that's a high vision. To accomplish that takes a lot of patience. A lot of patience. To accomplish that takes a lot of listening to others, a lot of inner listening to yourself. And it takes time. It takes real time. And it's a never-ending journey. There's no such thing as being educated. There's only becoming educated. You're always going to discover more. You're always going to discover new ways that you're connected, and all is connected to you. And that's really at the highest point of education. That's why, God willing, an educator, at the very earliest stages, is referred to, you know, in education, you send your children to a gun, or a kindergarten. What is a kindergarten? Literally, what's a kindergarten? Imagine this German word became so. What?
Garden.
Right, a children's garden. Now, why would that be the name for the initial stages of education? Why not send my kid to a kinder workshop? You know? Because really, education is growing. It's all about growing. But growing to become who I uniquely am. An educator is, in contrast to a carpenter, right? Very different. A carpenter takes raw material, and a carpenter imposes their vision on this raw material. You know? I take a piece of wood, I have this vision, I want this wood to become a table, a chair, a door. And so that's a carpenter. God forbid, right, that a rabbi should ever become a carpenter. Okay? Imposing, having some kind of preset agenda of how or who you will become, how you will look, it's not the role of an educator. Okay? An educator is more properly referred to as a gardener. Okay? And all an educator can do is create an environment, make sure that there's the right amount of sun and nutrients and water, fertilizer, you know. But I, as an educator, cannot, will not, don't want to change the essential element of who the individual is and the unique way they're connected to this all. Right? And that's it. A good gardener is very sensitive to discover whether this is a pear seed or whether this is a carrot seed. Right? To give it just the right environment so it can completely become, and its inner beauty and its inner fruition and its inner potentiality is really pouring forth. That's what an educator should be doing. That's what should be experienced in education. In Judaism, Torah is referred to as an Eitz Chaim, a tree of life, suggesting growth, development. The word chinuch is found in the Torah, in a very interesting context. Not at all in a context of education, but rather we find the word of chinuch in the context of the sanctuary, right? The Mishkan, the temple. In the temple, which we had a temple, we had once a portable temple, which was called the tabernacle, there was a tremendous amount of detail and instruction on precisely how it's constructed. And then once it's constructed, the various vessels, the altar, the various kinds of shovels and spoons, a whole array of various utensils and vessels. After that has been done, there was something called chinuch, right? They would do a chinuch. We also have the same idea in a house. We have something called a chanukat habayit. When you buy a house, okay, you inaugurate the house with a party called Chanukat, which is exactly the same word, chinuch, same root, Chanukat Habayit. Okay? Now what is a Chanukat Habayit? What is this party? What am I doing? I've got a house, I built this beautiful house. Okay? And now we have this party called Chanukat Habayit. What is a Chanukat Habayit? What do you think? What? A housewarming. Okay, what is a housewarming? It's a good word. What is a housewarming? You see, there's a difference between a house and a home. Unfortunately, there are people who have really astounding houses, and yet they really don't have a home. Okay? A house is a technical, you know, physical structure. But what makes it into a home? It's my consecrating it towards its intended purpose. Okay? What is the purpose of a house? Is the purpose of a house to show off to my friends? You know? Is that really the purpose of a house? That might be an interesting part of the house. But is that really what should be the considerations of the house? How loud it speaks on the street so that when people drive by? Or is a house to be an environment for relationships, for love, for sensitivity, for true understanding? See, that's the sad thing. The sad thing is a lot of people don't have homes. They live, yes, they did live in quite incredible houses. They didn't have a home. There was a secular philosopher that once said that if a person finds themselves, then they have a mansion that they can inhabit for the rest of their lives. A friend of mine once told me about somebody he knows, and he was kind of surprised this fellow had just built a house, but it really was a hotel. He said it was huge, the square footage, and it was just so many rooms, and the guy doesn't even have children. He said it just seemed crazy. So I suggested, you know, sometimes if a person doesn't find themselves, then they have to create an external mansion to compensate for the self which they have not yet found. So a Chanukat Bayit is what really gives the final touch to this structure. Right? Yes, it's a house, but what makes it a home is I consecrate it for its intended purpose. Okay? And unless it's fulfilling its intended purpose, the light, the warmth, the beauty is there. It's not there. So too, with all the vessels of the sanctuary, they would go through, or they would be part of this Chanukat HaBayit, which is this establishing, this literally consecration, right? For that this is its intended purpose. And then it's totally different. What does it mean then to be educated, to get a chinuch? It would be a life ceremony and a life celebration of consecrating myself to my intended purpose, how I uniquely serve in the sanctuary of life. That would be a tremendously successful education. Right? Tremendously successful education. So let's put it together. Chinuch is connected to this inner beauty, and this inner beauty, which is chen, is really that inner symmetry which is a function of the reflection of the all, the symmetry of all, reflected within myself. And that is a beauty which actually comes forth. More than that, as it becomes a little more individual, each individual in the universe, from the Jewish perspective, has a special service. A special service. A very special, unique calling, you might call it. And to find that is really the epitome of what education should be leading me towards. To do that. What I'd like to now do with you is I'm going to pass out a number of articles from a rabbi, Abram Isaac Cook, who passed away in 1935. He was the first chief rabbi of, at that time it was called Palestine, and I draw from a number of his articles. He was a great Talmudist, he was a great Kabbalist, very revered personality in the community. And I would like to examine some articles that he's written, which give us some added appreciation of what it means to be educated. So I'm going to pass it out. Now, as we're passing out over here, anybody have any questions on what I've said until now? Or any comments or feedback? Whatever. Pardon? Yes, Chanukah is very much connected to this whole idea. In fact, Chanukah is precisely connected to the idea of beauty, because the lights are lights that we look at but we're not allowed to use. Right? Unlike Shabbat lights, where we're actually supposed to use the light of Shabbat, the Shabbat candles. Chanukah candles, we're not allowed to use them. That's why you have a shamus. That's why you have that added candle, which is really for the light. But these candles are just to look at the light, for the sake of the light. There's a lot connected there too, in terms of the meaning of beauty and the meaning of what Chanukah is really all about. We're going to start at the top of the page. Understanding, reached by one's own mind, this is the highest expression of spiritual progress. Very important. I can't ultimately teach you anything, right? What you'll really, what I can do is facilitate, I can offer knowledge, but ultimately, understanding is reached by one's own mind. And ultimately, you need to be empowered, and you need to feel confidence, and you need to acquire the skills to come to that understanding which is born out of your own mind. Now it's very important to distinguish. There is two levels, or actually more, in Jewish consciousness according to the Kabbalah. There's something called chachma, which is wisdom, and there's something called bina, which is understanding. Okay? Chachma, I can give you. Bina, you have to get on your own. What does that mean? Chachma is a seed. In Kabbalistic terminology, chachma, in fact, is correlated to the seed of a man. Bina, on the other hand, in Kabbalistic terminology, is connected to a woman. Okay? The woman takes the seed, so to speak, and she houses the development of the baby. In other words, she, so to speak, gives back much, much more, right, than she received from the seed. So the Talmud refers to Bina is lahavin davar mitoch davar, to understand something from within something. In other words, you had a certain given knowledge, given information, okay? And then your responsibility to really be educated is to take that given, explore it, and give birth to it in a very unique way. And if you did that, nobody would come out of this program with the same insights, right? In fact, people would probably sit around saying, Rabbi Aaron said this. Oh, no, he said that. You know what? You're right. Okay? Because part of your participation in the process of education is to do the bina, to give birth, to take information, to take the given, but to draw out of it the unique meaning it has for you. So the understanding reached by one's own mind, this is the highest expression of spiritual progress. If you really want to make spiritual progress, you've got to be involved. If it's going to happen by you taking notes, it's not going to happen by taking notes. Notes are important. But when does it really happen? It really happens at night. It happens when you're sleeping. It happens when you're talking about what happened during lunch or during supper. That might be the most important time. It probably is the most important time that you will have here in Israel life. Okay? Which is not just the glass and the given, so to speak, and the dialogue, but now the intake and the birthing of the ideas in the unique way it means for you, the processing. Okay? And that will be where your spiritual progress will happen. But understanding reached by one's own mind, this is the highest expression of spiritual progress. All that is learned by study is absorbed from the outside and is of lesser significance as compared with what is thought through within the soul itself. Okay? So you really need to digest what's going on. And you really need to ask yourself what it means to you and to talk to your friends. But ultimately, what's from outside, what's in your notes, is of lesser significance than what you will give birth to of these notes from your own soul. All that is acquired by study is only a profound strategy as to how to draw on what is hidden in the heart. In the depths of the soul, one's inner understanding from the knowledge within. And that's really what study is all about. Really, you should see this time as a seeding time. And the growth of what you gain here, God willing, will be part of something for many, many, many years. If you make it into that. If it's just notes, forget it. You'll find your notes maybe years later with dust all over it. But if you really are part of the, in an active way of being educated, then it's important to know that it's not taking notes, it's not listening to classes. It's only part of it. But very much your own profound understanding, to get in touch with what you think, okay, what you feel, and what you can know. And that could take years. Hopefully it would take years. Knowledge in our inner being continues to stream forth. All right. Now here Rav Kook is giving us a very important understanding. That according to Judaism, there is knowledge from without, there is knowledge from within, and there is something very fertile in the encounter. Okay? But ultimately the knowledge from without fertilizes, so to speak, impregnates your soul. And your soul gives back, and your soul brings into the world even more understanding, more clarity, in a special way you needed to know it. Okay? Okay, I want to just go down, next paragraph. And with the emergence of such greatness of self, and that's very important, that's what would be emerging, when you're really progressing spiritually. A greatness of self would emerge. There is fashioned, with this emergence of greatness, the faithful ear, the listening heart. Okay? As much as you learn, as much as you come to know, as Adam pointed out, you will come to know what you don't know, which makes space for more. And this is what it says, in fact, in the second chapter, the second paragraph of the Shema, which you'll be studying a little bit in your prayer class. It says, "Va'ayim shamoa tishma'u," and it will be, if you hear, you will hear. How do you know you're really hearing? How do you really know you're really hearing? When you are open to be hearing more. Then you heard something. If you heard something and I heard it, you didn't hear it. When you're really hearing something, then it opens up even more. You hear more, and you hear more, and you hear more. And so education is a dynamic, ongoing process of birthing, of receiving, of growing, and listening, and your ability to hear, and your ability to hear, as much as your ability to say, and your ability to articulate, are simultaneously growing. That's important. An educated person is one who can articulate what they think and have the ability to hear more and to discover more. Okay. Let's go to the next little article, the inner spark. The inner essence of the soul, which reflects, which lives the true spiritual life, must have absolute inner freedom. This is a very important piece, which we will deal with, this whole notion of freedom. See, generally when one enters into an environment of education, especially religious education, then there's this fear, right? I mean, imagine, or maybe it happened, did you have the experience where you told your friend or a family member, "I've decided to go to Israel, I'm going to learn about Judaism. I'm going to learn about the religion." Have you had the experience where you kind of, they look at you a little weird, like, oh no. You think you're becoming religious? Right? Spelt with four letters. You know? And all of a sudden there's this fear. Why does the notion of studying a religion, or even say, well, I'm in a religious, you know, institute, which I don't suggest you use that word. Why? Because it conjures up what? What does the word religious conjure up? What?
Dogma.
Dogma. Right? That's what it conjures up. Oh, no. Right? Like what one of my students said. When she told her friends that she's going to Israel to study Judaism, so the first thing that people said to her, and it was an ongoing thing that people didn't even, you know, discuss, they all spontaneously at different times said, well, don't lose your sense of humor. Right? Because there is a sense that the study of religion is in fact a forfeiting of myself. Okay? A surrendering of myself. In fact, there's a sense that religion, right, is a form of enslavement. Okay? And yet the true understanding of Judaism, and that might be the true understanding of religion, I don't know, but the true understanding of Judaism is not that way. But the true understanding is to discover this inner freedom. The question is, what is that inner freedom, and what does freedom mean? Does freedom mean simply increasing my selections? Okay? And we will discover that a little more, but just for now, inner freedom, true freedom, is the freedom to be who you are. That's what it really means to be free. Okay? In its essential form. When I'm a slave, I'm not being who I am, but rather my life, right, is enslaved to fulfilling who you are. Okay?
True freedom is discovering who I am and what my ultimate contribution to the world can be in a very special way. Okay? And that's really the inner essence of the soul, which reflects, which lives the true spiritual life, must have absolute freedom. But absolute freedom can only come through knowledge. Because how can I be who I am if I don't know who I am? Okay? If I don't know what the incredible variables are, if I don't know what my potentials can be, if I don't know what the span is, it's like, you know, when I was growing up, that I literally thought that there was three things that you could become. A doctor, lawyer, accountant. Okay? God forbid I want to become one of those three. Right? But I almost did. In fact, as I was growing up, I kind of fluctuated. I gave up becoming a doctor, and I thought, oh, I'll go into law. And I said, you know, I don't really want to go into law, so I'll become an accountant. Okay? What I really wanted to do was I wanted to go into acting. But I was told that that's not a Jewish profession. I was told, yeah, you'll never make it. And what I really discovered is I didn't want that either. But I didn't even know that there was an option. So really, education is part of expanding your mind, getting a sense of options. But the freedom isn't because I have all these options, I can pick whichever one I want, right? The freedom is I am free to really know which one of these options is truly me. That's freedom. And so, it, the soul, experiences its freedom, which is life itself. Life, Rav Kook is defining for us from a Jewish perspective, is freedom. But we will have to better qualify what freedom is. Through its originality in thought, which is its inner spark that can be fanned to a flame through study and concentration. Here's a very important line. What is the role of study and concentration? What is the role of study and concentration? What are we learning here from this article? Fanning the spark. That's what I'm working on. I have an inner spark. I have an inner essential, unique me, okay, which must be free to be me, okay. And Judaism claims that that's precisely what Jewish education is all about. Even at first glance, one would think, oh, Jewish education is dogma and rules and regulations. How does this all jive? We'll be working on it. But ultimately, that study, if you don't allow that study to interact with that inner self, it's just all up here. It's all up here. And some people, you know, they study Judaism in a very academic way. You know, that's nice, you know. But in true spiritual progress, then one must interact with it. Must really take it in and put it out. And so, there's that inner spark. But the inner spark is the basis of imagination and thought. It's your inner spark which hopefully is going to be excited by, impregnated by, right, fanned by the study and the concentration. So this next little period of time that you have here, whether 3 weeks or 6 weeks, in terms of Israelite anyways, what an opportunity. Just what an opportunity, not because it's Israelite, but because here you are, there's no tests here, nobody judging you, there's no marks here. This is really a special time in the most special place in the world, in the backyard of what Judaism at least claims, and certain other religions also feel, very holy place, a real spiritual fountainhead, wellspring. So now is really an opportunity to really do some inner exploring, and we would like to facilitate that to the extent you invite us to do that, and that's important. I repeat that, right? Nobody's going to come on to you here, and you may even feel we're being cold. We're not. We're just being so, so respectful of your space and your process, right, that only if you invite us into your process with tremendous, tremendous hesitation still, we will enter. Because it's your process. And you must develop, and you must interact with this information. And we will help to the extent that you ask us to. If the autonomous spark should not be given scope to express itself, then whatever may be acquired from the outside will be of no avail. Nothing. Wasted time. Don't waste your time with notes and tapes, and it's all good. But the real work is how it hits you, how it strikes you, how you strike it, how you interact, the chemistry and the growing that's God willing going to happen. This spark must be guarded in its purity. Okay? And the thought expressing the inner self in its profound truth, its greatness and majesty, must be aroused. That's all we can hope to do, is arouse your inner spark. Okay? And an educator must have absolute, incredible respect. They can't have an agenda. They really can't. They can have a course outline, but not an agenda for who you are going to become and how you in your unique way will do what you in your unique way have to do in this world. And that's so, I mean, that is, to me, perhaps line one, you know, rule one to be an educator. An educator must respect who you are. I might have shared with some of you, I had a good friend who unfortunately passed away, who was very involved with what's today called outreach, or in Hebrew is referred to as kiruv, which is literally translated as to bring someone close. And this man was really, he devoted his life to the Jewish people. He had 70 people to his house for Friday night, for Shabbat meals. And he would not dump this on his wife either. I mean, he did all the cooking, he did all the cleaning. He was a very, very special man. And he went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichrono Levracha, for a blessing. You know, people have to go to Hasidic Rebbe's for a blessing. So he went to this rabbi. He said, "Rabbi, give me a blessing for kiruv, outreach." You know? And the Rebbe said to him, "You know, Rav Avraham, I will not give you a blessing for outreach, kiruv, bringing people close." Rav Avraham was shocked. You know, like, oh my God, he devoted his whole life and energy to kiruv, outreach, bringing people close, and now he doesn't get a blessing from the Rebbe. Not only that, but the Rebbe says to him, "You know what, Rav Avraham, I ask you never to use that word again." Wow, Rav Avraham was astounded. Never to use the word kiruv, never to refer to any, you know. And I hear today there's something called kiruv professionals, you know. So Avraham was really shocked. The Rebbe looked at him and said, "Rav Avraham, kiruv literally means to bring somebody close. Rav Avraham, who are you and who am I to determine who is close? Right? Who is really close to God? Who is really close to the essence of Judaism?" I don't know. Great. Lubavitcher Rebbe was saying this. He said, "Rav Avraham, I will only give you this blessing. I bless you to love your neighbor as yourself." And Rav Avraham told me this story, and this story has been a pillar of my career as an educator, which is, I teach as an act of loving my neighbor as myself. And if you love your neighbor as yourself just as much as you respect yourself, and you so much want yourself to truly actualize and be realized and really pour forth in the unique way it can in the world, then you want to see that for other people too. And so this is very, very critical, that this spark must be guarded in its purity. Don't let anybody take your spark. Right? Don't let anybody tell you what you think, or what you feel, or who you should be. Okay? Be open to hear, be open to converse, to dialogue. And the thought expressing in itself, in its profound truth, its greatness, must be aroused. This holy spark must not be quenched through any study or probing. God forbid that the study should in any way interfere with your inner spark. Then you're not studying. They're supposed to interact. It's supposed to be a real union. Right? But if you lose that spark, then whoever did that is criminal. I mean, that's might a little bit harsh, but I've seen, unfortunately, that happen to people, and I don't want to see that happen to a person. You know, I once met a fellow, and I was just here walking down the Kotel, and we strike up this conversation, and he's very involved with Jews for Jesus. And, you know, so I started to talk about Judaism, and I saw that he knew a lot, and then I realized he really knew a lot. And they said, "Listen, I want to tell you something. About 10 years ago, I was a Baal Tshuva. I returned to Judaism and became a religious Jew. And you know what happened with a short amount of time? I was wearing a long black coat, and I had a hat, and I was living in Meir Sharim. And I was walking down the street one day, and I'm walking past a store." No, this fellow that I met. He's walking down the street, and he passes a store window. As he's passing by the store window, he sees this Haredi-looking fellow, you know, carrying a cigarette, holding a cigarette. He saw this fellow reflected in the window of the store. And so he walked by and looked at this fellow. He walked back, the fellow looked at him, he looked at this fellow. Right? And to his shock, that fellow was him. And to his shock, that fellow was not him. They said, And that was it. I freed myself of Judaism. I realized that I had lost myself in what I thought was a process of tshuva, of return, right? I really lost myself. You see that? I'm not, you know, it could have been his fault too. You know, takes two to tango over here. So that was very sad that he lost himself. That can't be Jewish education. If we do that, we've lost the whole point. We've lost the whole point. And I'm not saying that that might not be an authentic garb. One might choose that this is a unique, special way and that they feel connected to dress in that particular mode. I'm not in any way diminishing the mode or the right to have any mode, right? But you've got to really guard the purity of the inner soul, the uniqueness of the inner soul, and not allow the study or the probing to quench it. And really in Hebrew it's more than that, because quench sounds like, you know, just you lose your thirst. Okay, but more than that, don't let it squash it. Okay? But rather, the study should be arousing it, fanning that fire. One more piece. What one soul receives from the influence of another, even though it may benefit it in some way, imparting some knowledge or good feeling, helping it occasionally, it harms the soul as well. Anything I give you, anything I teach you, unfortunately has a downside, because I taught you. Anything that one soul receives from another and is benefited, imparting some kind of knowledge or good feeling, helping it occasionally, it harms the soul by mixing an alien element in its essence. This is very powerful. This Jewish perspective on how such reverence we have for this inner essence. Okay? And that there shouldn't be an alien mixing. I don't want you to become David Aaron. Right? But you need to become who you, in your unique way, create the image of God, which is absolute uniqueness, is the image of God, you discover your uniqueness. And the world can become complete only through the negation of foreign influence. That's the only way the world will become complete. When everybody is doing what they uniquely have to do in this world, man shall no longer teach his neighbor, nor every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me. This is the prophecy of Jeremiah. Rav Kook is giving us a very beautiful, insightful interpretation of what this means. What is the redemptive vision? What does the messianic age look to a person? In that time, no one will ever educate you. Right? No one will say, listen, let me tell you about God. There's nothing I could tell you about God. Right? That either you can't discover on your own. Well, there's nothing, and my way of understanding God is anyways very unique to me, right? And yours to you. And therefore all will come to know Torah, all will come to know God, all will come to know the inner knowledge without the influence of somebody else. Young and old, the process of eliminating the alien influences threatening every individual through seemingly, though seemingly destructive, is the contradiction that leads to a more enduring and perfect building. I don't want to get to that right now. The sole gateway to the world to come. How does one get, so to speak, the world to come? Right? It's not by simply buying into the party line, right? And wanting to look like everybody else because everybody looks that way and you simply want their approval. But rather, he brings a verse, for God makes a separate Eden for each and every individual, as is written, drink of the rivers of thy Edens. So Rav Kook is pointing out the verse is in the plural. That there is not one Garden of Eden, right? That one will be going to, so to speak. But there are many. Each and every one of us has our own garden, right? But the way we get to our own garden is by having respect for each other, having courage to address our inner self, having the openness to interface, right? To dialogue, right? Have the openness to listen, the openness to give birth to ourselves.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2 627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.